See, I was in the education department for 3 years, you see, where I suppose it was, 1929 to 1932.
Yes, I noticed that. And I was going to ask you something about educational policy. What was the policy?
Again, I'm rather doubtful, but it was... well, I should think, I mean, what way do you mean, actually, the policy?
Well,
I mean, it is the promotion of literacy, that was, I should have said, all, and possibly introducing a bilingual element of English with Sinhalese or Tamil.
I see. Bilingual. Anyway. So there was there an attempt to foster vernacular education?
No, I should say definitely not.
There wasn't?
No, there wasn't. No, I was really, actually, I wasn't... I was in the education department for administrative purposes, really control of government of the government schools. Mm-hmm. I wasn't concerned actually with what they were taught or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I shouldn't have said actually, from my own point of view, there was any question of promoting them the vernacular.
What about technical education?
There's very little of that.
Don't you think there should have been some more?
Oh, I definitely think so.
Mm-hmm. Of course, there is this great problem in Ceylon. I consider it a bane today. This white, what I call a white-collar mentality.
Which is all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get it. It's a very much, it's very, very prominent in English now. In England now. I saw the other day, quite recently, in the I look at these things because I have an extra interest in labour problems. But there was a tremendous agitation in the ICI works, the International Minister, which is up here and in this part of Yorkshire. And again, there was a tremendous amount of ill feeling between the white-collar workers and the ordinary artisan.
Mm-hmm. Can't you fight this sort of thing?
Well, they're trying to fight. It's very difficult to fight.
Wasn't it a bit easier in Ceylon, in say, especially in the late 19th century and 20th century, to have done something to stop this thing?
I shouldn't have thought so.
Mm-hmm.
You see, because in Ceylon there was no industry.
Mm-hmm.
If there'd been, I mean, there was no occasion for it, you see. And in any cost, the question of the artisans were usually sort of, I mean, they were Indians for the most part, weren't they?
Mm-hmm. Don't you think that educational policy as such was too attuned to turning out a stream of clerks?
I think I quite agree. I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was. But that was the trouble in Ceylon, I think. I mean, reference to the criticism of our colonial policy. But it's the criticism of the colonial policy, but I don't think it's justified, because the same policy is pursued in this country. There's no question of the government development of industry, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
There should have been in Ceylon.
Much laissez-faire, then?
Yes. But that was the policy in this country, too. It was a policy all over the world, except in the communist countries, like Russia.
Yes, and this applies to education policy, too. When you have so many mission schools and so many... what one might call private enterprise in this field, it's difficult to mold it as such, isn't it? Education.
Oh, it is, yes, I quite agree. But that was the trouble in Ceylon. Well, trouble in any country in Asia, I think. And say, a man who's revolutionized it is a man in Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew.
Mm-hmm.
And he's... he's introduced actually a sort of socialistic element into the government of the country, which is absolutely essential. I mean, there were only half-hearted attempts at it in Ceylon. For instance, the man who was appointed by under Currier, Balfour, I don't know if you remember.
Director of Education later on, or Irrigation?
No.
There were two Balfours.
Yes, this was another Balfour.
Mm-hmm.
The Balfour, I think, I was in the civil service. He was a very good tennis player.
Mm-hmm.
He used to play with Rock, I think. And anyway, he was appointed, he was asked to develop industry in Ceylon. He was a hopeless failure. He had no idea about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
He was a bit of a chemist himself, and he spent most of his time sort of trying to develop things in which he was sort of technically interested.
Mm-hmm.
He was hopeless, and they want to. It wants to be done on a big scale. You really want it to have been far better if they'd got someone out of England, I mean, or somewhere, Russia possibly, if you like it, who'd been able to develop sort of commercial enterprise.
Yes, I see. And turning to these government schools, you administered them, didn't you?
Yes, I was responsible for discipline.
And what did you think of them?
Well, I thought that they varied so considerably. In fact, the trouble, what I found was that if you had in a government school a teacher who had been trained at the government training college, which was excellent, the school was first class.
Mm-hmm.
If you hadn't that, which was a toss-up whether it was good or bad,
mm-hmm.
but the government training college turned out first-class people.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think the curriculum was too English?
I do. I do, definitely. It was too much. I mean, for instance, take geography, for example. History, for example. There mm-hmm. were too much rather than to look at Ceylon. I mean, England rather than Ceylon.
I mean, now, who was responsible for this? Couldn't the governor or someone else have changed this sort of thing, if they were so inclined?
They could have done it, but...
Mm-hmm.
But you see, the... But you were saying the whole object, actually, of the government really was to produce clerks for the government service. And that was the height of ambition of most of the Ceylon youth who went through these places. I mean, that was the damnable part of Ceylon. I mean, there was very few openings for an educated Sinhalese in Tamil.
When the Donoghue Commission Constitution came into being, did the local politicians try to change this?
No, I don't know. You know, plenty of time. I don't know. I don't think they did. I made one effort to change it, which when I was the head of the Labour Department, which was failed much to Collier's annoyance, because I got I was reading the report of the Tea Research Institute. And they said there was a wonderful future, actually, for Ceylonese graduates in the tea industry if they had a science background and they were trained, actually, at the Tea Research Institute. So I took this up and I evolved a scheme whereby they'd be trained at the Tea Research Institute and they would then, after that, they would be sent to an estate. And I got the scheme that the government would guarantee their pay for at least a year, you see, until they attuned themselves actually to work on this thing. And I tried to get the Plants Association to accept it. They wouldn't. Well, Collier was very, very disappointed. He told me so about it afterward. And he wouldn't, because they wouldn't look at it.
If I may turn to the point at which I was going to begin, I was going to ask you why you joined the colonial service.
Well, I wanted a job.
Yes. Would you have, for instance, preferred the ICS?
Looking back, I might would have done at the time, but looking back on it, I much prefer doing what I did.
Yeah. Wait, what sort of feelings did you set out for Ceylon? 1919?
1914, it was.
I thought you were on war service.
Well, as I know, I was in Ceylon 14, and then I went to war service. Well, I don't know. I was young. I hadn't visualized the future very much.
Took it as it came.
I took it as it came.
You were in a public school in Britain.
Well, no, I was actually in a grammar school.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I was wondering then, because... Did this grammar school life help you at all in colonial service?
No.
University?
University did, because the college did. The Baylor had a tremendous tradition. And I remember, it's rather a long story, but Bale actually had the tradition of accepting, the different person put forward the point of view. You see, you analyzed, you accepted it as a point of view,
and
you analyzed it, and you didn't disregard it as being nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that, I remember being frightfully impressed with the actually of Anna A.L. Smith, he was the senior tutor, and I did with him. And it made all our difference. When I came to serve under Minister Collier, because he approached things from a very different basic standpoint from what I did, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, one had the traditions of the service and government service and that red tape and that sort of thing. And he questioned basic principles quite rightly too. And this attitude, which I've learned in Baylor's made me more receptive to these ideas than I might otherwise have been. This is only my own view, I don't say it's definitely true. But it made me sort of analyze sort of basic principles in a way that I'd never done before, you see. Now, continuing, when I went as a prisoner of the Japanese, I was head of the camp.
Mm-hmm.
Which no one, and the whole period of my service, which no one else was done in any Japanese camp at all. And I put it entirely due to the fact that when I met the Japanese, I was exactly prepared to, in the same way, to accept their questioning of my basic principles, which I approached certain problems. And I was prepared, actually, to accept from their point of view in a much more way than I used to have done. And I also think that saved my life.
Quite likely. What about military service? Did it?
No, I was only in the army for a year.
Oh, I see.
I just got a commission at the end.
And what were your impressions of the civil service coming into it as a rookie?
Huh? Oh, I was very impressed with them. Mm-hmm. They were very good men, the large majority of them. There were some bad heads, of course.
Was there much, at this stage, the 1910s and 1920s, was there much cynicism?
Well, my difficulty was, I was attached to the Secretariat at once, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know the people. I was never out in the district, you see, as a young, until very much later. So I couldn't really say what their attitude was.
Mm-hmm. In Bowles, for instance, in his writings, I see a strong strain of cynicism, but I was wondering whether Bowes was untypical.
Well, Bowes was a cynic himself.
He was a cynic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what was the prevailing shade of thought in British political terms? Tory, Liberal, Labour?
Oh, Tory.
Tory. Did this have any bearing on day-to-day matters?
Oh, I think it did. Because one of the troubles in Ceylon, when we went out there, was that the commercial people and the planters dominated the political scene entirely from a government angle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything that they thought, though the view was that in fostering trade and in fostering the plantation industries, that they were benefiting Ceylon, they were providing revenue for the development of Ceylon.
Mm-hmm.
And the planters and the commercial people dominated the scene considerably.
Well, this found to an extent in the 19th century too, and I think it's Furnival who was in Burma who makes this criticism.
Mm.
There was a tendency in policy to equate economic progress with social welfare, whereas it's not necessarily so. You know what I mean? Taking country as an unit.
Yes, quite. Yes, I mean, it was scandalous in that effect. In New Rayleigh, for example, if a district judge didn't get on with the planters, he was a district engineer in exactly the same way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose they couldn't do much about it regarding New Rayleigh anyway. Mm-hmm. Do you think they could have changed this policy?
No, they couldn't in Nevada, but they could. In places like where it affected, where it was more pronounced, I still thought, was in places like Retnapur and Bertram.
Mm-hmm.
Kandy, not so much.
And regarding this emphasis towards conservatism, Tories, would you say that Liberal and Labour supporters would have been more inclined to push for government interference, less of laissez-faire?
Liberals wouldn't.
Liberals wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. And the Labour people didn't come into
until much later. Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they would ever. I mean, ever have fostered industry in the way that is done at the present day,
mm-hmm.
which they should have done, of course.
And would you say that it was a predominantly Tory attitude to, say, trade unions, for instance?
No, I should have said, actually, of course, trade unions didn't develop until very, very much later.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Grunesinger, which was really child, I mean, stupid, I mean, he wasn't really doing anything very, very much.
Mm-hmm.
But by the early 1930s, I should have thought the development of trade unions was very, very much accepted, both by the Conservatives, by the Liberals, and by the Labour.
Early 1930s.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't until, Brackley, wasn't until I became active controller of Labour that the trade union movement really developed its salon or occupied a position of prominence.
Hmm. Respectability?
Well, that I shouldn't. I'm not in a position to judge because I was fostering them, you see.
Yes, I see.
Yeah.
Amongst the civil servants, I've noticed a preference for the revenue administrative side rather than the judicial side.
That was definitely.
Why was this?
Much more interesting.
Was it a question of higher status?
I think there was something of that in it.
Mm-hmm.
But you were much, I mean, you were tied to the bench. I don't think people liked the judicial mm-hmm. service.
Oh yes, and you would have the opportunity to ride out when you were GA.
Oh yes, it was a lovely life.
Mm-hmm. And in this regard, I would say that the British colonial tradition, and which was seen in Ceylon too, was to there's this tradition of pragmatism, rule of thumb, sending young officers out into the country.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think this was pushed too far?
I don't think it was originally. Well, I mean, before government became more complex.
Mm-hmm.
But now government has become complex. I think it could be carried too far because the problem doesn't arise now. But I can say from my own particular point of view of the Labour, I thought I was meeting new problems every day. But when I came to study actually the trade union developments in other countries, I found that the path that has been followed in Ceylon was very, very similar to that which was followed elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'd only had the opportunity actually to visit, say, Australia or England or something like that, and got some idea of the developments of the labour movement, I should have been much more successful in Ceylon.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I was so extremely busy with coping with current problems, I had very, very little time to study. I had a little time, but not enough.
Do you think that some sort of preliminary theorising in the shape of the course that they had later, the Devonshire courses, do you think that sort of thing was called for in the 1920s?
I think so, definitely so.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, I know, because Devonshire, of course, never affected me, but the second, there were two as far as I can gather, one before you went, and one when you'd been there for some time.
Mm-hmm.
But the second one I just thought was more valuable than the first.
Mm-hmm. And also, I have a suspicion that, you know, when you went out as an office assistant or as a young AGA, that more discussion was called for with your superiors and more looking into the history of the administrative history of a particular problem in Ceylon, for instance, the China problem. If they studied past government policy, this might have helped them to
Well, I don't think it affected the government agent. The office assistant, it affected the government agent.
Mm-hmm.
See, the office assistant, he didn't do very much about policy himself. Mm-hmm. I mean, he very rarely allowed to make an original order.
Yes, I see. What I was getting at was that this process of trial by error, though there is much to be said for it, also can do quite a lot of harm.
Yes, the amazing part of it is that it did so little harm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, have you read Furze's book?
Yes, I have. Not Furze's book, but I read Robert Huseless.
Yes.
He's consulted Robert, this kind of Furze. Ralph
Furze,
isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Well, this is interesting. I mean, he goes into the whole development. I don't know whether it's by him or whether it's by someone about him, I've forgotten. But I read the book, and his whole theory of recruiting people for service in the colonies was a public school education, but together with a university education. Mm-hmm. So you've got the public school and the varsity background, which developed character.
Mm-hmm. Elitist approach.
What?
An elitist.
Yes, that's right, yes.
And...
But I don't... I think the vast education, as a matter of fact, is absolutely imperative, would be absolutely imperative.
Mm-hmm. Despite this pragmatic approach, I was wondering whether, in the end, precedence dominated in day-to-day matters.
It did a lot.
Even in policy matters?
Yes.
Too much so?
Very difficult to know, you see, at the time, because it was this laissez-faire method that was adopted. I know, I wouldn't say too, it's very difficult to say. I know in the Secretariat they had the Eastern Book, you know, they had a book of precedents, you know, and you looked them up and that sort of thing. If precedent was established with regard to one thing, you accepted it. But I remember actually writing a minute in the Secretariat, it is saying that his government policy to do so and so. And when I was very junior, the fellow above said, government has no policy.
Yeah. No, because I make this point because Stace has written an article in which he says it was routine, too much routine. He uses the word blind routine. I wonder whether this has been rather harsh.
Well, I think it depended so much on the individual.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are all types of government. The danger was, I think, actually, with the government service, was that people remained there too long and they got rather tired.
Mm-hmm.
And they would...
lethargic.
Yes, they got lethargic and they would hide themselves behind a priest, which is a much easier way of tackling any problem, instead of sort of trying to sort of find out some new solution for it.
Mm-hmm. At the policy level, and even at the local policy level, in the provincial headquarters, do you think there was too much of a tendency to preserve the status quo?
No, I don't think that was so. I mean, they were quite prepared for developments.
Mm-hmm.
But what I the developments would come, of course, in the agricultural side and the engineering side and that sort of thing. And I think the trouble was that there was they rather left, actually, the major agricultural and other departments to work out their own policy as apart from that of the general administration.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you wouldn't now take, what I mean to say, now take the G.A. Candy, for instance. I don't think he'd work, actually, with the agricultural department and the irrigation department in the way that he should have done.
Not sufficient liaison.
Not sufficient liaison. Mm-hmm. I was very little outside.
Mm-hmm. Alluding to the 1920s, I would like to ask two questions in association. Don't you think there was a lack of purpose and drive in British rule? And that is to say, wasn't efficiency made an end in itself.
Yes, I should think it probably. I should say the trouble was, I think, the peace at all costs.
Let sleeping dogs.
Yes, I mean, the criteria as to whether you were a good district officer or not was whether the country was quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you were, they were quiet, I mean, whether there was an absence of petitions and that sort of thing, absence of complaints.
Yes, who was the colonial secretary in 1919 when he went into the secretariat?
Well, Graham Thompson.
Graham Thompson.
He came in very quickly, I think.
Mm-hmm.
No, wait a minute. Yes, he was, yes.
And General Manning was the governor.
Yeah.
And what are your opinions of these two men?
Well, Graham Thompson, I think, was, we didn't like him very much. Well, but I think he was definitely progressive.
A progressive. Bowes says that he disliked Ceylon intensely, and he was the only civil servant he knows of who did so.
I didn't know. I haven't read Bowes' book, mm-hmm. I didn't know he'd written one.
Well, actually, it's in typescript.
Oh.
It happens to be in Oxford, that's how
what?
It happens to be in Oxford.
I shouldn't have said that. No, what the little I thought of actually was Graham Thompson relied very much on the secretariat officers,
mm-hmm.
and Bowes had a very, very different idea of running the secretariat from what Graham Thompson did.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that he disliked Ceylon, I thought he did.
Yes.
I thought he liked it, essentially.
Well, I was trying to check on this. I was wondering whether Bowes was wrong.
I should say Bowes was definitely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I was there with him a second time, I know, when he was governor. He came and visited me in Trincomalee.
He was rather ill then, wasn't he?
He was ill then, but he was very, very much alive.
Mm-hmm.
I think he wouldn't have come back to Ceylon if he didn't like it.
Yes, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
What about General Manning? He was...
Well, lots of people regarded... I didn't know very much of him, in fact, but I've heard some degrees referred to him as one of the best governors of Ceylon here.
I thought he was more or less a pedestrian personality.
No, he was concerned very, very much with the constitutional problem.
Mm-hmm. I was coming to that later. Who succeeded Sir Graham Thompson?
As governor or as colonial secretary?
Colonial secretary. Clementi, was it?
Clementi, I think. Mm-hmm. Yes, Clementi.
What sort of man was he? He was rated to be very clever, but...
He's very clever.
Was he impractical?
Well, then I wouldn't know. See, the difficulty was, you see, that there was no sort of economic policy pressed from the Secretariat at the time. They left, actually, the economic development of private enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
All they were concerned with really was more or less with the
administration,
you see. And mm-hmm. And if anything, finance.
Mm-hmm. Didn't people like, surely capable men like Sir Hugh Clifford might have thought of something?
No, I think they're most... But some time ago, and I was very young then, I wasn't matured at all. But I shouldn't have thought that their idea of government was rather sort of the investigation of problems which you put up to them. I doubt whether they had any original policy themselves.
And
not in the economic field, not in the sense that you have it in now at the present moment.
Mm-hmm. What about Tom Southern, is it?
Southern. Well, I knew him very well indeed.
Yes. And he married Mr. Leonard's sister.
Yes.
And he was a very capable officer, was he?
Well, I shouldn't have. He was very mediocre.
Mediocre.
Don't quote me as saying that. He's a very personal friend of mine.
Well,
but I don't think he was really...
I think you were correct, because that's the impression I got from... Leonard Woos' book.
Yeah. He's not... he's a very nice chap.
Mm.
Very nice chap indeed. But I don't think he was there. I can't imagine him showing any initiative. He didn't do particularly well in Hong Kong.
And what about Sir Herbert Stanley? Was he a mediocre governor?
Well, he, of course, again, he had a different time. He was there when the nominal commission was introduced. And he introduced that quite satisfactorily. But from a constitutional angle, yes, but none of them really sort of were responsible for definite sort of aggressive policy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you think of it, I mean, the only man I can think of who was before my time was the governor who was responsible for the development of irrigation works.
Mm-hmm, I see, yes. And wasn't Sir Andrew Caldicott quite progressive? Or was he just
running? He was out of his depth. I always thought he was out
of
his depth.
He was, was he? Mm-hmm.
Well, you see, he, the trouble with Caldicott, don't quote me at saying any of these things, but the trouble with Caldicott was that he'd been in Malaya where there were no political problems. He'd been in Hong Kong where there were no political mm-hmm. problems. And then he came to the intensely developed political atmosphere in Ceylon. He was out of his depth.
But I thought he was fairly popular with the politicians. That's the impression I got.
He was popular with the politicians, I think, because he was a nice, well met.
Oh, I see.
But I got on very well with him because perhaps I said they shouldn't. He had perfect confidence in me. He must have done, because I would never have got promoted the way I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I should have thought, actually, that the most advanced by governor at my time was Graham Thompson. I don't know whether people would agree with me, but
mm-hmm.
Stubbs was exceedingly clever.
But wasn't he rather officious?
No, I shouldn't think so. He's rather cynical.
I think I got the impression that he was a sort who would think of matters in, well, he would be concerned about details rather than about general questions.
No, I think I say general questions.
General questions too. Mm-hmm. If I may go back to the 1920s, when this Ceylonization was rather an issue, and was it government policy to limit Ceylonization, have it very, very gradual in the early 1920s?
No, I shouldn't have said that at all.
They were trying to Ceylonize by then, were they?
Yes.
There was a political demand, and I know the politicians were dissatisfied with the extent of it.
I should have said, actually, that the people in Ceylon were in favour of civilization. So it was the colonial office who wouldn't break on.
Oh, I see. And what were the arguments used by the colonial office?
Well, that I don't know. Mm-hmm. I wasn't in touch then, of course, with the central government at all.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering whether the secretariat you saw any of these dispatches.
No, I was in the secretariat when I was very junior. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And a definite step had been taken, actually, to abolish the local division of the civil service. That occurred in my time, and that was the only step. It was gradually, sort of came on, but 50%, 50%, increasing. And actually, I know at one time, actually, we were advocating in Ceylon that no more Europeans were sent out. That was the Ceylon recommendation.
Oh, I see.
The Ceylon Association.
That was in the 1930s.
The 1930s, but Britain said no.
Mm-hmm. Because there's also a feeling among the Ceylonese civil servants that they were shunted into the judicial line and certainly excluded from the top administrative posts as GAs.
There weren't in my time. There were quite a number of Ceylonese GAs.
This is late 1930s. No, I was thinking of the 1920s.
1920s, definitely, sir.
Mm-hmm.
When I was AGA Manar, 1922, 1923.
Mm-hmm.
And I was succeeded by C.L. Wickramasinghe, who was the first Ceylonese ADA.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't so in the 1920s?
Yeah, it was just beginning, just becoming that.
Mm-hmm. Is certainly Boers was against this rapid form of civilization, and by that I think he meant a very limited civilization where he was arguing. And one of his arguments that was that the stability of government would be undermined. And would you comment on that?
I shouldn't have said so, no, at the moment. And in fact, I have a great respect for a lot of the civilians. Because, I mean, whenever you get in a government, I mean, if we look at the Europeans among the governments, among the civil service, there were quite a number, some of them, were complete failures.
Mm.
And you couldn't judge, I mean, you're not going to judge people by the failures, you've got to rather judge them by the successes.
I noticed this tendency in Boers to, you know, cite a case. You can always cite one case and prove your point, but it doesn't...
I mean, there were some very brilliant ones. Who was the... V. Kumaraswamy,
mm-hmm.
Modringa. There were two of people I'm thinking of. Some of them weren't so good.
Actually, the principal argument he employs is that... they wouldn't be accepted by the masses. He says, for instance, quote, in the Oriental mind, there runs a streak of distrust of his own brother and number, unquote. And that the people wouldn't believe in their impartiality.
Well, I wouldn't like to my own view is that that wouldn't be the case.
Certainly it wouldn't apply in Ceylon, because coming from these middle class and being a bit more assured than the peasantry, and invariably coming from good families, they were highly respected by the people.
They were able.
Mm.
I mean, he was a very able chap, so was Rodrigo.
And anyway, once you have this self, I mean, if you maintain this policy, self-government could never be achieved.
No. No, you want to actually, you see, what I should have liked to have seen myself, much more local government on the lines that there is in this country,
mm-hmm.
where you've got actually, to a certain extent, checks on the autocracy of the civil servant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you make him more responsive to public opinion and to public criticism if you have him associated with a democratically elected body. Yeah, I mean, if you put, the danger is definitely, I mean, if you put a mayor who doesn't know any European or anybody in charge of a province, in say, Kandy or somewhere like that, towards the end of his time, he becomes extremely autocratic.
Mm-hmm.
And you get, I mean, the same thing in England. I mean, Macmillan, when he was Prime Minister, he'd been too long and he got unresponsive to public criticism. That was one of his troubles. I had the same thing myself. I'd like to see him, but I don't know if I ever show Bowes and Brooks, not likely to print it, I suppose. But Bowes, he was quite a clever man himself.
He was. He was very able. I mean, that's the impression I get.
Yeah.
If I may turn to the constitutional aspect, is there much time?
Well, it'll be 12:30, I said I'd be with them if we're out.
Right.
Yeah. You understand, there's no reason why I shouldn't do it.
Who was responsible for these constitutional reforms in 1920 and 1924? Governor Manning?
Manning, oh yes, very much.
Very much his idea.
Yes, yes.
And,
he was responsible for reforms. I should think the reforms have been pressed from England too.
Mm-hmm. And after these 1924 reforms, would you say that the centre of gravity shifted from the Executive Council to the Finance Committee of the...
Oh, it did.
It did.
And where the Donald Moore came off.
Yes, that's right. And government didn't try to stop this.
But they couldn't.
They couldn't. What about this criticisms which politicians levelled at the civil servants in the Legislative Council? There was much personal criticism, wasn't there?
Yes. I know we used to get very annoyed about it ourselves. But
you were...
I think it was in us... Because it only just occurred to me, but possibly this personal criticism, which occurred actually in the Legislative Council, was more an indication of a wider-based criticism of the fact that the European civil servants were not devoting themselves to the welfare of the people at large, but rather the welfare of the particular sections of the people, like the planting and the commercial industry, you see. And that it was so. I mean, you could find criticism of any particular body, whether it had been Sudanese or European. But looking back on it now, they weren't. I mean, my own view is that, I remember Mark Young was very surprised that I said so. The introduction of universal man and suffrage in Ceylon made the whole difference, actually, to the outlook of government. They were a huge electorate now, whose welfare had to be considered. And to my mind, it was a tremendous advance there, an advance in the right direction. And it was merely an indication, possibly, of the politicians, like Sinanaka, who was voicing the fact that the Europeans were considering, as I say, not the welfare of the people at large, but the welfare of one particular section, and they weren't paying enough attention, actually, to the welfare of the villagers themselves.
Were the civil servants demoralized by these criticisms?
I think they were.
They were.
But they were much more demoralized, actually, not so much by the criticisms as by the attitude that the colonial secretary at the time, Fletcher, paid to the criticisms.
He didn't do anything.
He didn't defend the civil servants.
But the point was, he wanted to placate the politicians.
Yes, he had a difficult task.
And besides, it might have brought the constitution to a standstill.
Might have done, yes. It was a very difficult constitution to work, impossible, as the Donwell Commission said.
And you agree with Clifford's view of the constitution then?
Well, I've forgotten what it was.
Well, he said it was unworkable.
It was unworkable.
But Stanley said that cooperation outweighed opposition.
No, I think Stanley, I read Stanley's as well, and I don't think Stanley didn't understand the position.
He didn't. He was
remote from it, you see. When,
looking at it from the point of view of constitutional principles, it looks unworkable.
First interview ended here. I'm afraid the last few questions were rather hurried, and I couldn't get through the period thoroughly, but I hope to cover the other points tomorrow. That is to say, more on the 1920s and thereafter on the Donomo Constitution tomorrow. See you on the reverse side. Roger, over.